Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 25th, 1998. In the fireside building this morning, we have, it's called Healing in the Bible and Christian History. Let's listen in.
And things, so if I stick more closely to the script than I usually like to do, because I like to have eye contact and everything else, you understand. Okay. Since the question is this, since from biblical times, the jurisdiction, the authority to heal was seen as coming from God and to be carried out by the priests, by the rabbis, by the holy leaders of the time as a holy opportunity and a responsibility, you know, why has this turned around so much today? Because of historical events, especially what the rise of what we would call natural science, and then one of the branches of natural science obviously is medicine. The old priestly role that led to healing, well, this has simply been usurped. And what's happening now is that more and more people, this is sort of the theme of the whole week for me here, the theme is that more and more people are willing to allow for the possibility that such things as faith and spirituality and devotion like this can make a significant difference not only in sort of your mental attitude, but in the physical condition altogether. And I want to talk about this, and I don't know if you know, does the name Larry Dossey ring a bell with anybody here with prayer, intercessory prayer and all these sort of things? Okay. And then some of the others that we've talked about here. Okay. Now, in the Old Testament, very briefly here, and if you want me to talk, but there are some people who can talk faster. The fellow used to do a commercial on talking fast, and I can't remember. And anyway, he got you to pay attention. That's all they want you to do on this sort of thing. There are obvious health concerns in the Old Testament, such as with rites such as circumcision or with the ban on eating of pork. But there are larger concerns also in the Old Testament in connection with the relationship between sin and salvation, health, the ultimate, human destiny. Basically, I think what the New Testament is saying is something like this. After the fall, God and humankind tried to work out the broken relationship. The broken relationship between themselves, and also the Hebrews tried to work out broken relationships with their neighbors and with the world of nature. And what they were seeking to restore was this thing that's really sort of, in a sense, the theme word for all of this. They were trying to restore the sense of wholeness. And when bringing it back together in harmony and balance the way they thought, God wanted it to be. And when God calls for a new day of the Lord, this means sort of a new sense, really, of harmony themselves. There is a vision in the New Testament, in the Old Testament, which is very strongly, oriented towards what we call wholeness here, that is sickness and disease, war and famine, injustice and grief, all these things will be no more. And in that wonderful metaphor here, the lion will lie down with the lamb. And the way I like to put this is that the big fish won't eat the little fish any longer. The idea here of perfect harmony and balance permanently. And this is spelled out, of course, in Isaiah, and it's very nicely spelled out. And I'm sure many of you can recall your own favorite, specific psalms here. As I like especially Psalm 70 and Psalm 102, which deal with this sort of thing. It is a collection, these are collections of prayers and hymns flowing from the very heart, of course, of Jewish spiritual life, which have been influential, obviously, from that point on. And in Psalms, we see the inner wrestling, really, of the human soul. All the emotions, the conflicts, the doubts, the hopes, the fears and longings of, what we call our common humanity are laid bare in the presence of God. I think that's one of the attractions for the book of Psalms, and, if you want to comment on this. But when we read them, we know that they are talking about issues that we are talking about. We can feel with the writers of the Psalms, their particular issues because they have captured, a larger humanity. It doesn't matter if they were written 3, 4, 5,000 years before, but they are as real and vivid to us today as they were in the times in which they were written because they touch on the thing of the common humanity and that therefore there are certain issues, this is what I'm getting at was the whole theme of healing here, there are certain themes that are just as relevant. I mean, it's just as relevant to use scriptural foundations and sources as it is to read the modern things because they were onto something that, we are onto ourselves. You'll find in the book of Psalms the yearning for wholeness, the healing in all areas of life, body, mind, and spirit. And of course, there were some healings in the Old Testament, but I think one thing I want to emphasize that before you get into too much continuity between the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, there are some differences, and one very significant difference here that I want to talk about. In times of physical and mental disturbance, as we have, for instance, with Job, the seeker turns to God, and that the faith that is attendant on turning to God is that which the seeker feels will heal him on this. The deeper, in other words, the deeper one's spiritual life, The more one, the seeker, tries to find God and finally does find God, the greater the assurance that wholeness, balance, harmony, healing, all these things will take place. God is the creator of all things and is the only power able to heal. And when obedience follows, the commandments of God, then here's the point, then one can expect wholeness, health, happiness, these things. It really is a matter of turning to faith and expecting these things to occur. Illness, in other words, results when one is not spiritually attuned to the active presence, of God. A full, trustful attitude towards what God does for the faithful is what will, restore wholeness. Very much a total dependence on that, and in a way which they feel has created a kind of a harmony or balance. Yet, if I'm not being healed, and I'm off the subject quite a bit, thank you. If I'm not being healed, it must be something that I'm doing wrong, or it must be something that I'm not doing. So then you add to your number of prayers or devotions or your spiritual life and these sort of things in order to please God. It gets to be sort of a works of righteousness sort of thing, very difficult. But there's no question in some cases illness is a result of human sin, if you want to call that. Smoking would be, I gave you my example last night, smoking would be a very good example there. There's nothing, I don't think, that nobody's claiming, some people claim that you can inherit alcoholism, isn't there some teaching that way? Okay. But I don't know if anybody who says that you inherit, the weakness to smoke. I just don't know of that, anyone for that one. And of course, I've got all, as I said last night, I've got all the obnoxious zeal of a convert on that one, so I think I got to leave that one, alone.
Bernie Siegel's first book had a lot of that blaming of cancer. People, and he got so many responses negatively from women who had breast cancer and mm-hmm. other people, and so he changed his subsequent his revisions. But that was very hurtful, because here they were bearing the burden of the cancer, and then to have an added burden of guilt that they had.
Oh yeah,
had done something.
Devastating, and I was there.
They had done something.
That they had no smoking. That it was more. Interpersonal relations and stress.
Well, I've heard talk, that there is sort of a personality structure that is more vulnerable to cancer than others, especially if you don't express yourself and let loose with your emotions and everything else. Once you get, as far as I'm concerned, once you get into this game, you can say just about anything, you want to improve a whole lot of things without, what is it, written without fear and without research. Isn't that the usual statement? Okay, New Testament. There are dozens of interpretations, really, of Jesus and his miracles. And one of them, obviously, is the Bultmann school, that the miracles were added afterwards as a way of sort of convincing the doubtful that this really was, the Son of God. And that the miracles really, as such, didn't happen, but they become commercials, obviously, for Jesus. Okay. And what I want to look at here is, what did Jesus really intend to do with the miracles? Why were they so central to his ministry? And then the more important, then the question that follows, whatever happened to the miracle ministry of Jesus? Why did it sort of go into abeyance for such a long period of time? Clearly, Jesus had two purposes with his ministry. One was teaching, and the other was healing. No question, teaching and healing were the two central focuses that attracted his attention, and he gave us his whole life, really, too. And interestingly enough, from that point on, Christianity has become, among world religions, Christianity has become one of the preeminent religions that focuses on healing. You can go to others, and the healing just isn't an issue. Let me give you an example I like to talk about. In 1978, 1979, I was fortunate enough to lead 16 St. Olaf students on what we call Term in the Far East. And interestingly, there's a Holden connection there. One of them was young Andrew Hinderman, who was the ultimate Holden child. He was born almost here and brought up and everything. And if you knew Andy, you never forget him, but that's another story. Anyway, we were in Chiang Mai, which is 700 kilometers north of Bangkok, and it's the center for a form of Buddhism called Theravada Buddhism. Okay. And we would go to different temples each time, and we'd have courses in Buddhism. And we'd go once, and there was one fellow, his name was Ajahn Chitrapon. And he was showing us some things with yoga and all the rest, and he delivered a lecture standing on his head. I know some of my students seem to think that's the way it comes out when I lecture, but at least he actually was doing it himself. But the point was, we got to know some of the students there very well. They were English majors, and of course they enjoyed being with us and trying out their English and learning and learning all the latest, you know, music and fashions and everything. And one day we were downtown, this little boy was, nickname was Tom, and I saw some beggars, and some of them were, you know, without legs and things, and I, you know, expressed some sort of sympathy, you know, for these. And Tom looked at me without batting an eye, and he says, "Beggars make a good living." It was just one more, you know, field, one more thing to do, one more sort of occupation or something. There was no particular sort of sense of compassion. I don't say this judgmentally at all. There was no particular sense of compassion for people who had this particular handicapped position. And there are no programs in, for instance, in Thailand for rehabilitation or for training the handicapped or the disabled. This isn't anything else. You wouldn't find the wheelchair or the thing for parking, you know, for disabled or anything else like this. This just isn't a part of the way of looking at things. This is simply karma, or this is bad karma, if you like, the way things worked out on this. Okay. But things are different, and here's where I think Jesus clearly breaks with the Old Testament on this. He healed, I think, for several reasons. One, for his sense of compassion for the needy, for the hurting, the outcasts. They're obviously a person, you know, of great care. In other words, he didn't accept pain, illness, and infirmity as the normal order of things. That's the key. If I don't say anything else today, that's what I want to stress. He didn't accept pain, illness, infirmity as the normal order of things. Live and let live. That's the way life is. Sort of a fatalistic view at all. He didn't accept this from the beginning. Okay. He saw pain, illness, suffering as contrary to God's order, to what God really intended for people. I think that's just very simple, because some people just become very stoical and sort of accept this, and we can't do anything about it. There will always be, you know, like they always, that expression, there will be war, rumors of war. Some people say there will always be illness or something else like this, and you might as well sort of accept it. That is sort of leads to the second point, and that's Jesus' teaching of the kingdom. And this is where the clear break obviously comes with the Old Testament. The kingdom, we were talking about a little bit about this. The kingdom is now, and the kingdom is yet to come. Very difficult for some people to understand, and I'm not sure I always understand it, but I think that's central here. The kingdom is now, and the kingdom is yet to come. He is the Messiah, and he is ushering in the kingdom, but the kingdom isn't here until sort of the final culmination on this. So what? So healing that Jesus did, and I've got a list here, if you're interested afterwards, this is from Kelsey's book, on all the different specific ministries, I mean miracles that Jesus performed, especially healing ones. He's got 41 listed here. That all these miracles are signs that the kingdom is here and now, that the new order is here, that we're not going to accept the status quo any longer. That's just central to the whole thing. That we, you know, you have heard it said unto you, but I say unto you, and not only in the teaching thing, but in the doing thing also, that there is a reversal of this sort of thing, because the kingdom is here and the kingdom is now on this. And this is clearly different, as I've got my notes here, this is clearly different from the Old Testament. And another point here he's arguing, and we sort of talked about this before the alarm went off, illness, pain, all these things were not there to be, some people say, character builders. That if you have an illness or ailment of some kind, you're supposed to learn persistence, patience, courage and all these things, sort of character builders. Illness, pain were not conditions that people brought on themselves, with a couple of exceptions. And so he's not telling them, obviously, to accept their infirmities really as punishment. This is just really simple to the whole thing, that the kingdom is now, and the kingdom means, and the kingdom is yet to come, the kingdom is now, and that means that we should fight, reverse the normal order, not the traditional ideas that accept pain, illness, and all these things as the normal order of things. Okay. Now, I think you can put this in another sense, in the way Jesus sort of taught about the, you know, the what we would call the flesh or the body. Let me try that and see if that comes out clearly for us. For one thing, we teach that God created the flesh. God is responsible for the flesh. God the Creator is responsible for the flesh as well as for the spirit. And so therefore the body is a holy temple. The body is something good, something worth preserving. The body isn't, as oftentimes has been the case, sort of a sewer or some other place where Satan dwells, although I want to talk about Satan and spirits a little bit later. And secondly, in terms of the body, God obviously is best known to us through the incarnation. Do we want to know what God is really like? And this is the thing I always say, that the best way I understand what God is like is through the incarnation, through Jesus. There are a lot of other ideas, and there are a lot of other teachings, the moral principles and all these things which are fine and helpful and good and all the rest. But the clearest understanding of what God is like is through Jesus. And I talk about this when we talk about what I call globalizing Christianity. What is the one thing that's unique about Christianity that we bring to all the things with Buddhism and Hinduism and Islam and all the rest of these things? And that's the incarnated God, the one who is here and now and doing these specific things. That God showed himself to us in terms of, you know, of the physical characteristics of a human being. So God is known, God creates the flesh, God becomes incarnate in the flesh, and then whatever it might mean, in the final analysis, someday God will resurrect the flesh, or God will resurrect the body. We aren't exactly sure what that means. I give a talk on whatever happened to heaven and hell. But we know that there will be a final day where the resurrection of the body will take place, whatever that might mean. And so obviously God takes the, what I'm saying here is that God takes the body with ultimate seriousness. And it isn't just sort of something that, what is it Lucy says in the comic strip, Peanuts? You're born, you do some stuff, and then you die, and that's about it. What is it there's in one of Aldous Huxley's novels? Life is one damn thing after another, after which there's one final big damn thing, after which there isn't anything anymore. And that about sums it up. Time must have a stop. That was his one. Eustace Barnett. That was, okay. Then, of course, the question, I'd like to get some discussion going, is, you know, what about demons? What about demons in terms of health? Because obviously what Jesus does is perform exorcisms. And for a long time that was taken very literally and seriously by the church. But clearly I think in our day, with a few exceptions, the whole idea of exorcisms, of having demonic possession and all these things is pretty well, is for some people embarrassing. Because obviously the idea is that through, with the whole field of psychology and psychiatry and all these things, we know much more about mental illnesses, and to attribute these things to, you know, demons and evil spirits is simply sort of quaint or provincial or something else like that. And this leads to what, you know, remember the comic about 20 years on television, Flip Wilson, The Devil Made Me Do It? Mm-hmm. And what people are arguing, if you blame it all on the devil or on Satan or whatever else, you're denying personal responsibility. For evil doing for yourself, and I couldn't help myself. And there used to be a comic strip. There was a comic strip too, but there was a, remember the great TV comic Red Skelton, and he was always having the good side and the bad side tempt him. And I'm trying to remember the punchline. I shouldn't bring it up if I can't remember the punchline. But I did it, and I do it. What was it? I didn't want to do it, but what was that line? Remember, he was very funny about that, that we're always being tempted by the good and the bad.
But what I don't want to do?
Which was it?
Paul? St. Paul?
No, but I'm thinking, he had a punchline that he used in all of his skits.
Yeah.
I can't remember, but anyway, I'm trying to find some sort of down-to-earth practical examples of this. Some of this still lives. For instance, one of the best sellers in all of, you know, Christian literature is this novelist Frank Peretti. Who's got books that are very, very popular, selling into millions of copies. People take this, you know, very, very seriously. And I myself, I don't know what to make of it. I mean, sometimes I think there must be such a thing as demon possession, and other times, once you sort of open up that can or that thing, then where do you end with this sort of thing? And, you know, where do you, because then it leads to things like the Inquisition and to the Salem witchcraft trials and all kinds of terrible things, yeah.
Last professional leaders conference in Arizona, the bishop that came from a synod, I won't say where, but he came, and he was speaking about all kind of good things, and then he kind of stopped and he started talking about that we need to pay more attention to the subject of evil and spiritual, I don't know if he used demons, but. And he talked about exorcism, and he said that he has had some new vision or understanding of that. And in my reading, I have found some more liberal-minded, more moderate-minded theologians who are calling attention to the subject of evil as not just a movement or a mysterious force, but more personified. And I will share some more with you later in private
okay.
about that subject, because I've had some encounter with that.
And the only way I can account for or understand that all Nazism is that there has to be some sort of demonic force at work. The Holocaust can't be, as far as I'm concerned, understood in any other terms than something like this. So outrageous, you know, there aren't words, obviously, even to begin to explain that the Holocaust, that something evil had to be turned loose on the world here at this particular point. And the trouble is that some people start blaming everything on it. That's what I'm trying to say.
Our whole liturgy, when we talk about baptism and you read the part about you renounce the devil and all of his works, is a form of exorcism.
Right.
And it is written liturgically in our history for thousands of years. I think that we need to really spend more time working at understanding it. I really understand your fear of opening a can of worms, I can tell you that.
Because you can find the evil where probably evil doesn't exist, or devils or Satan or something else like that, where it may not exist.
Well, Luther said, the devil, the world, and flesh, the devil, and so he saw more than one root cause of evil. He didn't look at it as just a force. He didn't look at it just as persons. He didn't look at it just as one of things. He looked at it three ways.
And he had some wonderful quotations about that. He liked having the devil around because he argued, someone thinks the devil, he said, visited us last night in the refectory. And he said, I heard him clinking around and knocking around. And you don't know when Luther is being serious and when he's being playful. But he liked it because he said, that must mean that I'm getting very close to being, closer harmony with God. The devil has to worry about me because I'm getting closer to God. If I weren't close to God, the devil wouldn't pay any attention to me. And so on. And Bruce Benson, our college pastor, asked me to do a chapel talk. And he said, put together Halloween and Reformation Day and All Saints Day, because they all come October 31st or November 1st. And see if you can put these things together in 15 minutes or something else like that. And I tried on different things, and I found some quotations where Luther was talking about the devil visiting there, and he had no particular problems with this. But the way in which I put the Reformation and Halloween together was, I said, if you've ever seen full-length portraits of Luther, obviously he didn't have photography in those days, if you've ever seen full-length portraits of Luther, you know that Luther practiced tricks or treats. Because you're supposed to laugh at that point. Treats, candy, he's overweight. Halloween, okay. So if you have to explain a joke early, forget it.
That's right.
That's right, if you have to explain it more, I should forget it, but cross that one off. Okay. The interesting thing, of course, then, is that after Jesus' ministry ends, it was the healing ministry was continued, we find in the book of Acts straight through, but then comes clearly the disappearance of the healing ministry for a great deal of church history from that point on. And there are still people who are wondering, why this should be the case. For one thing, there is a major argument going on in evangelical and in some fundamentalist circles over what we call the cessationists versus the restorationists. Some say that the gifts, and Luther taught this, Calvin taught this, and all the rest, some say that the healing gifts, the spiritual gifts, that were there ceased with the end of the apostolic age, and heaven come back. And the restorationists say, obviously, that the gifts never left us, that we simply haven't used them before, and we're just now coming back into being able to recognize that the gifts, especially the gift of healing, were all there. And this is a battle, and it's a proof text battle going on back and forth. And you can find places like, Trinity Deerfield in Chicago and near Chicago and all these things, battling these things out and being very, very outspoken about this. I just sort of leave that to these specialists in that case. But clearly what happens, I think, is that the enthusiasm for healing starts to fade clearly by about the second or the third century. And I think in part it was because this was the age in which, what was it, the average lifespan at best was what, 50 years, maybe even less than this thing, the age of pestilence and plagues and disease and all these different things, that life itself was such a perilous kind of adventure or very difficult kind of experience that it became simply central just to survive rather than think of finding any way in which you could sort of stem this sort of thing. This last, the huge things, the Black Plague that comes, and these go on, obviously for centuries.
Okay, and as a reason, one of the
one of the bases for the monastery's beginning and some of the orders was over the issue of providing healing.
Right, and sometimes as an escape away from the plagues, a place apart. And the monasteries and the convents did try, some of them tried to have a ministry to healing. And that was that sort of thing. But in terms of the, the scope or the numbers of this, it simply faded into obscurity because the problems with pestilence and illness and all these things were just enormous, I think. I was going to suggest here, using Evelyn Frost, who is a famous British historian who's done a lot on this, people with this sort of fear that, you know, tomorrow may be the last time started turning to more miraculous kinds of ways of dealing with the illness. We start the beginning, for instance, of shrines, which are the culmination, of course, which would be Lourdes in France. Shrines to the veneration of relics as other forms of supernatural experience to try to cope with the very difficult problem of staying alive itself, rather than seeking out what we would call sort of base causes, which would be the beginning, for instance, of natural science. It really isn't until well into the 16th, 17th century that we get the beginnings of natural science, which really turns this around. And there were also at this time the origins of what we would call the snake oil peddlers, the quacks, the people who come along and offer sort of things, which, you know, people in those days simply had no choice or they had no alternatives but to believe. Okay. And finally, I think on why the church itself stayed away from this, ministers were the only organized group at that time dealing professionally, you know, with the matters of death. The only organized group dealing professionally with the matters of death. Hence, when they came to see the patient, the patients associated them with, you know, now it's time to get ready for death, rather than see them as agents for healing, and or rather than to try to find new energy really for healing. I want to be sure. Does that make any sense? I'm going over these, but I'm not rushing here. But I'm happy to get at this point to Luther, because Luther has some wonderful things to say here. It's very, very helpful, and it's sort of a nice bridge to what I want to be talking about on Thursday. I have tomorrow off on this. Luther, in a way, helped pave the way for today's complementary alternative medicine, or emphasis on mind-body healing itself. In his rediscovery of the gospel, which had always been there, but which he, you know, founded in, he found the need for one thing, which is, to me, fascinating. He found the need for forgiveness. This is so central on this. That is, he accepted the very modern notion that before much healing can occur, and we'll talk about this especially with visualization, the very modern notion that before much healing can occur, one has to get rid of what the people today call the weeds in your garden. The weeds are such things as shame, guilt, jealousy, pride, which, if they are still there, will block any kind of healing that takes place. And I like the metaphor of pulling these things out, and you'll find some of the exercises that I have for visualization, where they get the people to see their lives really as full of weeds, and you pull these out as best you can, shame, guilt, jealousy, pride, all these things, and then healing can take place. Luther found forgiveness, obviously, in the gospel, and in a sense he was getting rid of forgiveness. And what's fascinating, and I've just found out this, there's a fellow at my school, Madison, in the field of educational psychology, he has a research program going now on forgiveness. This is in the Godless State University down there where I went in Madison, you know, and learned all about the things that I didn't learn about at St. Olaf, like Freud and Darwin and, mm-hmm. and Marx and JEPD and some other things that, weren't taught at the time. Okay. But he's teaching that obviously significant, you know, healing can occur when one goes through a program that he has sort of laid out of seeking out forgiveness. This is just an amazing kind of thing, you know, from a secular position. He's got a foundation, he's got some John Templeton Foundation money going for this sort of thing, and people are taking this seriously. And it's an example of what I'm trying to suggest, that this CAM stuff is now being taken seriously. And he's going through with interviews, and he's got students doing doctoral research, dissertations on these things, on the importance really of forgiveness. And by forgiveness, the simplest way I can understand it, you simply give up carrying a grudge. You don't forget wrongdoings or anything else, but you simply give up, you know, carrying a grudge. I have one grudge I still like to nourish and nurture, you know, from my experience at Sinloff. I really don't want to give up on that one. It kind of makes me feel good. Somebody didn't get tenure. And I really blame blah, blah, blah for that one, and I like to hold it out, and maybe the other people were right, but I don't want to admit that. So that's my problem here with carrying a grudge. All right.
Well, that's the reason I have a problem with our Lutheran liturgy, where the pastor says, I forgive all your sins, yes. When in fact, unless there's been a process of person to in fact, person experience release, then to me, we just put frosting on top of it and have compounded it. That's personal, that's what I think.
What do you think? I think I have, you know, I think I know where you're coming from on that one. Very difficult, because you build up your pride and you build up your case. By George, I'm on solid ground, and the other people are pretty much on quicksand.
Have you confessed that you can? Have you offered it to God at that time? And the answer is no, in that you haven't offered it to God.
But what we say there in the ritual.
No, you haven't offered it.
And what we say in the ritual that you have.
But don't you have to accept it?
Well, I think, the fact of the position of our power positions, pastors, puts us in a position that's already done, when in fact I question why we do it, and if we really place the importance on the process of forgiving ourselves, we can release it. In working with patients, I've seen it takes a considerable amount of time to do that, not in terms of just a ride.
Let me give you my example. This wrist here, some of you know this, none of you were carefully, but this is the retreat center, and we were going to do a Luther hostel there, and John and Marcus did, and I needed some cough medicine, and I walked off into the black and out in near the desert, and Carefree prides itself on being sort of a counter town. It doesn't have any street lights at all. They just sort of pride themselves on this, and among other things. So I walked off thinking I knew where the Bosch's grocery store was, where I could get my Robitussin and all the rest of these things. And I stepped out, and I was rather sure of this, and I didn't realize there was an embankment there. And I stepped right off into the black and fell about this high, and the hand went down like this, and I never lost consciousness or anything. And the first thing that struck me, you know, strange things happen on these emergency situations. The first thing struck me was I remembered a line from, of all things, a Ronald Reagan movie. I mean, I'm sure some psychotherapists would have a wonderful time with that one. Boy, I should remember that. But it was his great line, "Where is the rest of me?" Because what I did was started, you know, I'd fallen down, and I wanted to know, is everything still working? And I started twitching, and that's what I was worried about, and my toes started to twitch. So I figured, and Reagan woke up in the movie, remember, and his leg had been amputated, and where's the rest of me? And I soon found that everything was twitching, you know, with this. But then what I found was the bone, you know, I felt the bone moving in my wrist. Oh my God. You know, that got my attention. I mean, right there. And then off in the background, some coyotes started in. that didn't help. But then Bob Hudson, I don't know if you know Bob, he's a pastor down there. And Bob said, you know, when he was trying to reassure me after I, you know, got back into things, Bob tried to reassure me. He said, "Really, don't worry. The coyotes never come until the blood is cold." Now that's really all. Thanks a lot, Pastor.
Oh my God!
I have to remember that one.
Yeah, right.
That,
I don't know if he's, you know, Bob is half gas and half really good stuff. Wonderful guy. Absolutely one of the best. Called to him, clearly has a call to the ministry. But anyway, then I got back again, and then they got me down to the emergency room at North Memorial, and I won't mention his name at that because he didn't do a very good job. And then I said that before, and somebody said, "We want to know his name. We don't want to, you know, have to go to him." But my point was that it took me a long time to forgive myself for this really stupid thing that I did. And I told a couple of people here that when I was in the rehab center, the bishop came and he gave me two things. He gave me a prayer book and he gave me a flashlight. I had Howie as a student, and so on. That sort of stayed with me.
Did you get your cough medicine?
I never got the cough medicine. I never got the brushes. But then it's a long story. Oh, and it's complicated. Ruth, my wife, had already put. She knew I needed some, and she put some in my room up in the retreat center. But I didn't know that. So, but the sum and substances that I lost. People say, "Well, how do you feel about it?" I said two things. One, I lost 12 weeks out of my life. And the second thing, I learned how Medicare works. And I just assume not know either of those things, but that was for. I had to take a long time of forgiving myself because of that. That's the point, because it was such a dumb thing to do. You know, walking out into there and not, you know, and that was hard to do, but I've, you know, I can't come to terms with that, because otherwise you keep blaming yourself. Warren, you're doing it.
Well, you know, when you say forgiving yourself, Roy says the, when we say you're forgiven for your sins, all of your sins, oftentimes we don't forgive ourselves.
Right.
But we're still forgiven. You know, on the cross, Christ said, forgive them, for they know not what they do.
Right.
And there is a forgiveness there. But oftentimes we get a wrestle, and our own sense of forgiveness and our own sense of holding a grudge. And then, you know, yes, we're forgiven, even though we don't want forgiveness.
Yeah. You nurse that little grudge or something.
That's
else.
That's right.
Or I'm such a big sinner that I've done such terrible things that God couldn't even forgive me.
So the forgiveness doesn't depend on me.
No.
My feelings and my what I'm about. Yeah. It's bigger than that.
What we call objective grace.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. In the Eucharist too. That, you know, how do you prepare yourself, you know, for forgiveness? But doesn't the act, you know, of forgiveness happen regardless of whether or not you're, you know, this is what we call, isn't this what we
I
call
hope
objective
so.
Grace?
I think it's already happened. I don't even think about the idea that God hasn't forgiven me. I only work in the area of coming to accept it.